This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Phil Cohen was a Chapel Hill bus driver in the late 70s. He was frustrated with the way things were managed, and he let those frustrations simmer for years before deciding he would do something about it. And that is when he found his calling. Since then, Phil has traveled all over the South organizing mill workers and defending those unions that suffered under free trade agreements and a flood of anti-union labor laws. Today, he's here to talk to us about his new book, Fighting Union Busters in a Carolina Carpet Mill, an Organizer's Memoir. In it, he details strategies and obstacles to defending an industrial union in Eden, North Carolina. Eden's at the confluence of the Smith and Dan Rivers in Rockingham County, up near the Virginia border, about 40 miles north of Greensboro. Phil Cohen, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Let's talk about this flooring plant in Eden. Bit of an outlier in some ways. I mean, in the first place, it survived the 90s free trade agreements, but it also remained a union plant for more than 70 years. And then union membership started to decline in 2017. That's when you got the call, right?
Yep, that's right. What happened during the fall of 2017 is a management-sponsored decertification petition began circulating in the plant. And by definition, that's illegal, because under the National Labor Relations Act, which has been in effect since 1935, management is supposed to remain strictly neutral when it comes to matters of union representation. But I've found in 30 years in the field, there's no such thing as a decertification campaign that gets off the ground without management's involvement and support, because frankly, it takes a professional to run a campaign and see it through. But knowing isn't what matters. The challenge is proving it. And I received a phone call to go to Eden on November 3rd, 2017, to investigate and expose Mohawk's illegal involvement in this decertification effort.
Well, let's talk about this, too, because the fact that there is a decertification, that we're decertifying a union in North Carolina in 2017, is almost a story in itself. How did it manage to hang on so long?
It hung on because of good representation that folks appreciated receiving. And also, look, Trump's policies on the labor movement, Trump's, I would call it, war of genocide against the American labor movement, kind of opened the door that sounded a bugle call to employers who would have preferred not to have representation, that you now have my appointees heading the National Labor Relations Board. You're going to have a much easier time on bending the rules and getting away with things. So if you ever wanted to get rid of your union guys, now's the chance. Mm.
Although I think in a lot of ways you'd have to agree that Trump was late to the game when it comes to an attack on American workers, to some extent, got underway. Well, we won't go back into the deep history of that. I want to talk more about your effort in this and your engagement. Walk us through the process that followed. You get called. There's a decertification campaign underway. Pretty sure management broke some rules to get it started, and now you're involved. So what's the process?
Okay. First, I got called in at the 11th hour and 59 minutes. I mean, frankly, the union should have sent me in a month earlier, as soon as the petition hit the floor. But I didn't get called in until the petition had actually been filed, and the NLRB was in the process of scheduling an election. And I had 36 hours after my boot hit the ground to not only investigate and file sufficient charges of unfair labor practices to block the election, but back that up with an offer of proof, listing witnesses and what they had to say. And suffice it to say, it was a sleepless 36 hours. Mm. It almost got derailed by broken hotel computers that wouldn't allow me to do certain things I couldn't do on my laptop. But eventually I got all the paperwork to the NLRB by midnight on the day requested, based on the substance and merits of our allegations and the list of witnesses, they blocked the election. Doesn't mean they shut it down, it means they put it on hold. And then naturally my job was to deliver. I had to further investigate, meet with all of these witnesses, convince them to overcome the terror many of them had of retaliation.
Let me interrupt you there because that is key. So I do want to hold you right there and talk more about that.
Sure.
Obviously, the employer holds a great deal of power here. Witnesses are key to your process. What sort of protections can a union offer in the workplace, and what does it take to convince them that they're going to get those protections?
Look, the National Labor Relations Board is a law enforcement agency of the federal government. And the one thing the Fed, under any administration, has no use for is people who tamper with their witnesses. So what I tell folks, and it's the God's honest truth, that if someone provides a sworn affidavit to the NLRB, first, it is kept confidential. The NLRB will discuss with the employer the types of evidence being compiled against it, give them a chance to rebut it, but it does not provide names unless a complaint is issued, appealed, and we go to trial, and then naturally witnesses have to come forward. But were an employer to identify one of its employees as whistleblower, in a sense, that employee would automatically have to screw up twice as bad as normally in order to get themselves fired, lest the employer be accused of retaliating and terminating a witness of the federal government.
So what kinds of things were these witnesses telling you?
Okay. Management was using one of the most common and essential tactics to gather signatures. They were paying a small, hand-picked group of anti-union employees to, rather than run their job for 8 hours, to roam the plant, go into various departments, you know, carte blanche to violate the no solicitation rules, the out-of-department rules, to gather signatures. Now, what's critical about that is that sends a message to employees that these coworkers are agents of management, that they suddenly have a whole new level of authority. Clearly, management is backing the petition, or they wouldn't be allowing these workers to do this. So maybe they better sign, because, you know, management always wins. They're big, they're powerful, they're rich. And, you know, so probably the union's going to get you certified, and if my name's not on the petition, what's going to happen to me? But beyond that, Mohawk committed the capital offense of union busting, which is direct solicitation by management of signatures, and in this case, often involving coercion. Three members of management, the department head, the plant human resource manager, and a corporate human resource executive, were ultimately cited by the NLRB for numerous counts of direct solicitation of employee signatures, often involving some pretty significant arm twisting.
Now, so that involvement, the direct involvement in the decertification process, is one of the ways that management worked to try to, you know, get their side to win the day on this. The other side you talk about, I think the other important factor that you talk about is the anti-union messaging and the way that works its way through the workplace. Tell us more about that.
Okay. So if a company wants to get rid of a union, they have to work through a group of employees. And an interesting aspect, one of the unique aspects of this campaign, I mean, it's always a game of divide and conquer. I mean, to put it down to a real simple equations, union campaigns are about unification. And decertifications are about divide and conquer. Not all that different from the Trump-Biden election. And so the divide and conquer is normally along demographic lines, and in the South, more often than not, it's white against black. But in this case, the divide and conquer was based on age. They appealed to they hired a bunch of new folks in 2016, and they appealed to this younger generation of workers, folks in their 20s and 30s, by saying, you know, in our non-union plans, seniority counts for nothing when it comes to layoffs, when it comes to promotion or job bidding. And right now you've got folks in here with 30, 40, 50 years of seniority, but you are much better employees than them. And if we got rid of the union, you would jump to the front of the line.
Is that true? I mean, so that might be a message, but it also might be a policy. And would that be something they should consider as they decide whether or not a union really does represent their interests?
You know what? First, it's highly unethical. For someone who's been in the plant for 2 years, to think that they will get rid of the institution that would guarantee someone who's paid their dues and, you know, raised their kids and been in the plant for 40 years should go ahead of them if there's a layoff. But secondly, and the most important thing to remember, look, when you're appealing to younger people, they normally live in the right now. I mean, gee, about 5 million years ago, I was younger people, and I lived in the right now. So I understand that thinking. But in reality, so you have 2 years seniority now. Some of those older folks have retired since the decertification fight. You know, 10 years from now, they're going to be senior. And a lot of the people who are senior over them now will be gone. And then they will have seniority that means something to them, that offers job protection for them and their families. And they would not be at the whim of management's favoritism in terms of critical areas like job bidding and layoff.
So tell us how this turned out.
The NLRB, I'm not to spoil the book's ending, but the NLRB issued the most massive complaint against an employer during my entire 30-year career of fighting decertifications and filing other types of labor board charges against the company. It was an absolutely massive indictment of Mohawk's involvement in this effort.
I think it recommends the book. This is unusual, particularly in the South, North Carolina, the most non-unionized state in the South. I think it's about the most non-unionized or among them in the country. And so to have this kind of a story, I think it recommends the book and how it all turned out. What do you think turned the tail? Because clearly other companies have been quite successful in this process. What is it about this process and perhaps your involvement, if you want to blow your own horn here, that made a difference in this case?
Look, I'm a specialist in fighting union busters. When companies send in union busters, Workers United sends in me. And I have never had a union local decertified on my watch in 30 years. And part of that involves simply being a really good boots on the ground field investigator. And the other involves the fact that I'm working people. I come from a really rough working class background. I did blue collar work for 20 years, was leader of my own union local for 8 years. And so workers recognize me the day I get there, that I'm one of them. I'm not some egghead who decided to save the working people. I'm one of them. I have been there. I've dealt with employers who treated me like a piece of garbage and tried to violate my rights. And it's being able to win people's trust quickly, to get them to overcome their fear, to be able to engage people in that part of them that wants to do the right thing, that wants to be an advocate for the truth, and to have that overcome the part of them that's terrified of authority and wants to just, cover their own butt. It's also a question of being able to explain really complicated legal issues and the rules and procedures of federal agencies in terms that working people with no experience in the legal arena at all and understand. But being working people myself, I speak their language. I speak the language of lawyers, and I speak the language of floor sweepers. And that diversity puts me in a position that people will talk to me and that people will come forward for me.
Let me ask you another question. And by the way, I've just been told North Carolina is the second lowest union membership in the nation, so that is for the record. But let me ask you this, because also North Carolina is a so-called right-to-work state, and the defenders of that law will say that, look, nobody should be told or forced to join a union, and that should be a choice, and that in places where union membership is mandatory, this is an infringement on their rights. How do you respond to that?
They're only talking about half the equation. The other half of the equation is that unions in right-to-work states are forced to provide representation for non-members. Now, I made the acquaintance of a union rep in the Netherlands a number of years ago when I was in that country. He was with the workers' union. And he said, you know, in our country, workers do not have to join the union, but we don't represent them. And there's a certain amount of fairness for that. Okay? I mean, if you don't think an organization is worth belonging to, well, fine. But then you don't get to participate in the benefits that it has to offer. But forcing unions to represent non-members, one, it appeals to the lower side of human nature, the part that says, well, if I can get it for free, why shouldn't I? Mm. And so that that deterred people becoming members. And the unions having to nonetheless spend, you know, time and energy and resources representing these people drains the treasure chest of unions. I can tell you for a fact the Southern Regional Joint Board of Workers United, which is now a division of SEIU, it's never turned a profit in my 30 years in the field. In fact, it is subsidized by a considerable amount of money by the national union and always has been just to exist. And that tells you right there, more eloquently than anything, that we're a cause, we're not a business.
Phil Cohen, I'm going to have to cut it off there, but it's been great to talk with you. Phil Cohen, the author of Fighting Union Busters in a Carolina Carpet Mill and Organizer's Memoir. Phil, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, it's been my pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
You can find a link to that book and the rest of our show at stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.